and welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm film critic April Wolf. This week's episode was recorded live at Resident in downtown LA as part of the Voyager Institute's lecture series. So the recording will sound a little different than usual. You'll hear some noises in the background, drinks being made and enjoyed, and people having the time of their lives. Seriously, it was really great. So without further ado, please enjoy this conversation with Sarah Gertrude Shapiro about The Craft.
Coming up right now is someone who we actually had as a guest at our very first Voyager Institute back in August of last year. And she has one of her great podcasts is Switchblade Sisters. She is a film journalist and a good friend and someone whose work I just respect a lot. Everyone, welcome April Wolf.
Hi, everyone. Do we want to play the theme music or no? Just guys. Yeah, cut it out. Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm film critic April Wolf. Every week I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, producer, and we talk in depth about a fave genre film, maybe one that influenced their own work. And today, I'm so very excited to have writer, producer, director, Sarah Gertrude Shapiro.
Hi!
For those who are not as familiar with Sarah's work, please let me give you a quick bio. Sarah started her career interning with Christine Bechon's Killer Films and David LaChapelle before she earned a producing spot on the ABC's on ABC's The Bachelor, which would prove to haunt her for the rest of her life. After multiple seasons of coaxing emotion from sexy singles on that show, she left the industry and began producing for ad agency Wieden & Kennedy up in Portland, Oregon. And according to Wikipedia, growing kale. While she was there, she wrote a script for a short film based on her experience on set of The Bachelor, and it took it to the AFI Directing Workshop for Women. The finished product was a short... I'll go faster, I promise. The finished product was a short titled Sequin Rays. That short scored her a meeting with Lifetime, where she pitched an expansion of the film into a TV show, and that show is what became Unreal. Yes, right? All big fans? It's a series starring Constance Zimmer and Sherry Appleby that chronicles the exploits of some deeply troubled feminists as they vie for power and sanity behind the scenes of a dating reality show. This meta creation has since won a Peabody Award, fancy schmancy, and been nominated for Critics' Choice Awards and Emmys, and the third season is airing on Lifetime, not as we speak, but maybe as we speak if you're listening to this later, we'll see. That season is getting very good reviews, with critic Emily Nussbaum calling it, quote, such a weirdo blend of twisted feminist wish fulfillment and hatertainment, brah fucking bah. The reviews are in. I'm so excited that Sarah chose one of my favorite films from when I was a kid. Not really a kid, I was a bit older, but... it's also having its anniversary about 2 days ago. It turned 22. She chose to talk about The Craft. And could you give us a quick explanation of why The Craft?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was really thinking about that because it was an instant answer when you guys asked me, like, what genre film influenced me the most. And I was thinking about why. And I think it was so inspirational to me as a team. You know what I mean? Like, it was just exactly what we were feeling and exactly who we were. And it was, like, so much magic and all this, like, maximal sex and, like, just, it was, like, so bad, you know what I mean? And I think the way that it really inspired me was like, go big or go home, and you don't have to be good to make something. Like, it's really, there are so many parts of it that are so bad, you know? Like, the special effects are unbelievably horrible. But the truth of, like, just the chaotic sexuality of it, I think, is obviously sort of still something that I explore. It just happened to something really deep for the coven that I was in high school. So my coven was very affected by the craft.
I also had a coven. For those of you who have not seen the craft, today's episode will give you some spoilers, but that should not stop you from listening before you watch. My motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you would like to pause and watch the craft, you can do that now. You guys can't because you're right in front of me, but people who are listening later on, you have the option. So I'm assuming that you're back. Now let's introduce the craft. Written by Peter Filardi and Andrew Fleming and directed by Fleming for release on May 3rd, 1996. We almost made that exact 22nd anniversary of it. The craft stars Robin Tunney as Sarah, Fairuza Balk as Nancy, Rachel True as Rochelle, and Neve Campbell as Bonnie, four young outcast witches who find each other in their stiflingly white, jockish high school. Each girl has her own specific insecurity: Sarah's depression and suicide, Nancy's shame at her white trash upbringing, Rochelle pain and confusion from the overt racism she experiences, and Bonnie's embarrassment about her badly scarred body. Sarah turns out to be a pretty powerful witch on her own, but altogether they can finally invoke the power of Manon. They use the power to have fun with the classmates who bullied them for a little while, but Sarah grows unsure about their behavior, while Nancy grows more violent and risky. When Nancy takes things too far, killing a jock guy that done her wrong, played by Skeet Ulrich, Sarah cuts herself off from the coven, but the three are out to punish her for leaving, and an epic battle of witchcraft ensues. So that's the gist of it. But it's so, so much more. I would love to talk about Fairuza Balk, just real quick.
God.
Let's just start right there. And I don't even know if I have a question for this. So I just wanted to say...
commitment to a role. like committing to a performance.
I think, you know, I don't know... I feel so terrible because I feel like she embodied this role almost so much that she really couldn't escape the typecasting in that sense.
Tricky.
and that's the thing. It's just like, can you imagine having seen this movie and you're a casting director and you're like, no, shit, she's Nancy. She is not Fairuza at this point anymore. And I feel like that is, you know, a difficulty for an actor. Everyone who knew her, like, the reason that she was cast because she was an actor's actor, everyone was just like, yes, this girl who was in Gas Food Lodging, who was, you know, in Return to Oz. And I was just wondering, you know, what's your love for Fairuza? What's your love for Nancy? Why do you love her so much?
I love her so much because she's kind of like the frenemy that all of us had, you know what I mean? Like, I feel like we had that person in our coven that sort of, like, was the really charismatic leader. I think we sort of took turns being that person. But one of the reasons I love her performance in this movie so much is, like, she doesn't even blink. I mean, she just goes so hard right at it. It is not written all that well. I mean, I love this movie so much, and I know the people that made it. So I'm just saying, like, it's a very, very kitsch role. And she commits so fully, you feel like she's, like, bleeding out of her eyeballs. I mean, I admire that bravery so much. I can't imagine actually playing that role.
Have you had, an actor that you've worked for who just, like, you're like, oh, shit, that person just went for it?
Yeah, a lot.
Can you share any experience of...
I mean, I think Constance. Like, Constance, who plays Quinn in Unreal, kind of all the time. Like, she shows up on set, and you just... she does stuff that you... It's so vulnerable, and it's so brave, and it's... She just commits 1,000%. Like, she is not hesitating.
What's the weirdest line that she's had to say, do you think? Like, when you wrote it, you're just like, oh...
She had a very hard time with a lot of stuff season one because I think she was really concerned about the tone, and she was sort of like, I believe you and I buy it, but I don't know who the hell this person is or, like, how we're going to do it. I think in the pilot, it was, it's not my fault America's racist and Obama's barely black and what were some other things? Make my pussy wet. She was just like, I don't... It was because we're on Lifetime, we actually can't cuss very much, which has been such a strange experience for me. It's like running with cement shoes on. Like, I just have the dirtiest mouth. So we've had to sort of invent cuss words, and she
like
has...
Frack.
What?
You're like, frack.
Yeah, no, frack we do. And she has had a very, very hard time with, like, hoo-ha. She's just like, I just can't. And so, like... So, like, seeing that actors have to commit to the word hoo-ha is pretty intense. And she's done it. She's pulled it off. And then there was a scene where she had to trash the control room because she had just found out that she couldn't have children. And that's a really, really, really dangerous territory to be in on Lifetime. Like, that could go so wrong so fast. And I think that was probably the hardest. We would have to ask her, but I think that's probably the hardest thing she's had to do. And I think she did it amazingly.
Okay, well, I want to talk about some of the things that Firouza had to do, some of the lines, because I wanted to play a few of those lines for sure. The iconic lines, because I think the writing in this is just, it is everlasting.
It is.
Like the name of the show on your show. So first, I want to play a scene where the girls are riding the bus on a field trip.
Girls, watch out for those weirdos.
We are the weirdos, mister.
We are the weirdos, mister, is something I think I've quoted a million times in my life.
It's everything.
It's
so 90s. It's like quintessential 90s.
It's so 90s. There's another short one that I wanted to play, too. It's a scene where Skeet Ulrich realizes that Nancy really is a witch, and there's just a small exchange that I just absolutely love.
You're a witch! They were right.
They usually are.
I love the exchange of, they were right! And she's like, they usually are. Also very 90s, though.
So 90s.
But how would you classify, like, what makes it so 90s, do you think?
I was actually thinking about that, and I think, like, the economics and, like, sort of the global political situation at the time was so, like, fruitful and stable that, like, there was this very earnest alt situation.
Yeah.
Like, there was actually room for people to be, like, weirdos because everything was so fucking normal. You know what I mean? Like, I really remember that sensation. I grew up in Santa Barbara, and it was, like, just living in a postcard. I mean, it was before 9/11. Like, we had never really been attacked on our soil except for Pearl Harbor. You know what I mean? Like, I just feel like there was this quiet ennui, like this nothingness, and it left so much space for people to have rebellion. And it was very earnest. Like, it was very straight ahead. Like, it was cool to be like a weirdo. And now I feel like culture is so appropriated and scrambled that that doesn't exist anymore.
No, it doesn't. Although I can see, like, in your show, there is a little bit of, like, Rachel kind of having that past or having that kind of existence before. I can feel that from her character.
Yeah, and I feel like one of the reasons why she's struggling to have a new identity is because that doesn't actually have social capital the way that it used to, even for her. Like, it's not something that brings her comfort or connection or community anymore. It's just, like, baggage that she has.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be right back to our conversation with Sarah Gertrude Shapiro about The Craft.
The Dead Pilot Society podcast brings you hilarious comedy pilots that were never made, featuring actors like Aubrey Plaza, Andy Richter, Paul F. Tompkins, John Hodgman, Adam Scott, Molly Shannon, Busy Phillips, Tom Lennon, Anna Camp, Laurie Metcalf, Felicia Day, Michael Ian Black, Adam Savage, Paul Scheer, Ben Schwartz, Skylar Astin, Mae Whitman, Josh Molina, Ben Feldman, Nicole Byer, Jason Ritter, Sarah Chalk, Steve Agee, Jane Levy, Allison Tolman, Danielle Nicolette, Casey Wilson, Anna Ortiz, Lorraine Newman, June Diane Raphael, Kiernan Shipka, Ed Week, Zach Knight, and Carrie Kenny Silver, John Ross Bowie, Jamie Denbo, Janet Varney, Alexander Torsani, Bruce Summer, Morales, Matt Worley, and many more. Listen at MaximumFun.org, iTunes, or wherever you download podcasts.
Welcome back. You're listening to Switchblade Sisters. This is a live conversation I had at Resident in downtown LA with Unreal creator Sarah Gertrude Shapiro. Please enjoy.
I want to talk about the development process of this film, The Craft, because I always found it was very hilarious that it was two kind of white bread dudes sitting around. It was Peter Filardi, who'd just done Flatliners, and Doug Wick, who had just done Working Girl. They got together, sat around, and talked about witchcraft and teenage girls and sexuality and identity. Like, that's how this movie came about, was a bunch of men sitting in a room being like, this is really, like, a sweet, sweet story about, like, girls. Like, they just really fell in love. with paganism, with witchcraft. Like, they dedicated their lives for a long time to
And Doug is still like that. I know Doug. And Doug is a beautiful human being, and Doug feels this very, very deeply. Like, I mean, like, he knows so much about witchcraft.
That all of the interviews, I was so impressed with, like, he almost downplays. He's like, well, you know, I went to some ceremonies and rituals. And I'm like, no, dude, you went to ceremonies and rituals. Witch. He's a witch now at this point.
I mean, I love Doug.
And I also love, like, when Filarity was in the early processes before Doug had, and Andrew Fleming had taken over, it was Filarity suggesting also that these kids had to be of a lower class. Because he was like, well, you know, paganism is actually rooted in the oppressed. And so he was going back into, like, early, like, deep research to embed this story in that. And that makes it, something about it just seems so beautiful and real, even though it does seem a little bit surreal and cartoonish. And I think it's through that research and that collaboration where each person brought their own thing to it. And I would love for you to talk about the process of collaboration and how a story can get from point A to fucking all the way over to point B. And it's, you know, may not even look exactly the same from the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great question. Having come off of, like, I'm just finishing my fourth year in television, and feeling like prior to my television experience, like, I was a very singular person. Like, I was very much like had a weird little closet studio in Portland and just sort of sat there alone in the rain a lot. Like, I was very, very much in my own head. And so collaborating on television is really, really necessary just for the volume of work that has to be done. And I also think it's incredibly fruitful. I think on Unreal, having different voices in the room, like different ages, different genders, different ethnicities, like, I just feel like all of that has been really, really vital. And I also think that it's about kicking the tire on ideas. And when you get the same feedback from three people, you kind of have to take it. You know what I mean? Like, for all of us, as we're breaking the story and as we're working as a writer's room, we have become so intimate and know each other so well that it starts to feel like a hive mind, but we all know what the other one is bringing, and we really can sort of, like, check ideas that aren't working. You know?
What's the biggest shift that you've had in a story that you can think of from someone suggesting something or taking a different direction?
Try and think of something specific. I guess, like, really, this is more of a global answer, but so the show is about the producers that make a reality show, and the network has been continually pretty fascinated with the actual reality show, which I never intended to write. Like, I just, like, kind of refused to write it a bunch of times. And I think what's been interesting in that collaboration is that we actually have found some really interesting storylines in that reality show. And it's been a good challenge for me as a writer to find a way to keep the tone and voice of the show active while interplaying in a way that's, like, really, really poppy and super commercial. Mm-hmm. So I think that was an interesting one. And very early on, like, in season one, there was a scene where I wanted Rachel, the producer character, to, like, fuck a FedEx guy when he came. That was sort of her arc for the episode, was that she was, like, feeling like shit and, like, overdosing on Cheetos, and she hated herself. She was living in the back of a grip truck. And she just didn't know what to do, so the FedEx guy came, and she pulled him into the truck and fucked him and wouldn't let him get off. And then by the end of the episode, she let him get off, and that was her character arc. Like, she had become more generous. So, like, she didn't let him get off in the beginning, and he said, I feel like I got raped, and she said, you did. And then,
so dark.
Yeah, so that was 100% what I had planned to do. And the network was like, you know, it's a little far for us. We don't, and I was just, you know, I had my total hissy fit, like, if I had sold this to HBO, I wouldn't even have this fucking conversation. So I had my hissy fit, and I went to my office, and then ended up coming up with something that I like so much better, which is that at the beginning of the episode, she's in her grip truck trying to jerk off to porn, and she can't get off. And by the end of the episode, she is jerking off to a video of a guy proposing to her in Mexico the summer before, and she orgasms hugely. And so that actually felt more grounded and like a more interesting story to me. Like, it had more layers. So I have really had the experience of having some parameters be very helpful. Like I thought those parameters challenged me in a good way. Like, I had to tell the story better.
But I'm glad that your show does get dark. Like, that shit gets very dark. Did you ever have any pushback, though? Like, with Lifetime, when initially, because this is a new show for them.
Yeah, it was a very weird situation, you know? But like, interestingly enough, I actually, in the beginning, had a situation where I think we had overcorrected in anticipation for what they were going to want. Because I had made this short film that's pretty dark. It's not, nothing really crazy happens in it, but the tone is very, very dark. It had gone to South By. It was like not anything that anybody thought was going to end up on Lifetime. And through a weird set of circumstances, they offered to buy it before I even went to South By. And they just came at me hard, and I had a weird, like, witchy intuition that I was supposed to say yes. So I did. And so at first, like, the first draft we turned in, I think, was skewing way towards the pop. Like, it was broad, because I think we thought that's what they wanted. So we actually got feedback in the beginning to go deeper and go darker. But then when they gave us permission to do that, it got like, whoa, fuck, that was really far. So I think it's been a matter of calibrating. But the nice thing for me is that that actually my sensibility does skew kind of pop. And I think that, you know, I have the experience right now with The Handmaid's Tale, which I think is so incredible. I think it is such an incredible piece of work, but I actually just can't bring myself to watch the second season. And so I feel like, I guess the only reason to say that is that I appreciate having some buoyancy in Unreal, like the glitter and the sparkle and all of that stupid stuff that I was sort of refusing to write in the beginning has ended up being like a pretty crucial component of the show. And I don't think it would have gone that way somewhere else.
Yeah, and I love that it's on Lifetime.
I do too now, like, very much so.
It's such a great fit for it. Yeah. It's also, I mean, I think that you had something good where there was a female audience that was built in at Lifetime, and I think I'm just going to say it, a lot of studio folks who are men, they don't actually know how to reach out to women, and they're afraid to reach out to them, so things become complicated. Like, when the Craft was coming out, they were like, oh, witches?
Yeah.
Like, young girls?
Yeah.
They were like, girls aren't going to want to go and see this because they don't like dark things, and boys aren't going to want to see girls in the lead. And so they didn't know how to release this movie or what to do. And we brought this up actually on the Amber Benson episode when we talked about Night of the Comet, which had two female leads in a sci-fi story, where the studios have no idea. They just don't know. And there's just so few movies like this. I think one of their comps was Heathers. And that had come out years and years before The Craft. And so that gives you, like, an idea of how few and far between these stories were.
Yeah. And that's actually so interesting, because one of the very functional, like, sort of almost, like, rudimentary things that was easier at Lifetime than it would have been anywhere else was having two female leads. We actually didn't even talk about it. And then somebody told me it was really noteworthy. Like, when we started working with casting directors, they're like, wow, you haven't had any pushback? And I was like, why? What? I don't know. But so Lifetime was so used to doing that that it didn't even raise a red flag, and that would have been very hard someplace else.
I want to talk a little bit about Rachel True, who is a fan favorite of this movie too, and how pivotal this role was for maybe not even necessarily her, for True herself, but for a lot of young Black girls who didn't fit in and saw themselves reflected finally in this character. True was very grateful for this role because it gave her a chance to do a movie that wasn't a quote-unquote hood movie, which was something people expected a lot of Black artists to do at that time in the 90s because of the popularity of movies like Boys in the Hood. So when Fleming saw True Reed, he reoriented the character from being a bulimic girl to being a girl dealing with racist taunts of her classmate. So it was kind of tailor-made for her, and what he called her, quote-unquote, humor with a hint of anxiety, which I think, you know, you can see that you don't get that much from her there. She doesn't have as much as the other girls.
She really doesn't.
She doesn't. So I still think that, like, young African-American girls were just like, oh, I'll take whatever I can get, you know? But I wanted to listen to the way that she delivers even just the small lines. Here's one where she's talking about Nancy and how Nancy can't magic her way out of being white trash.
What's wrong with Nancy?
Her spell's not working.
What spell?
I don't know. I think she doesn't want to be white trash anymore or something. And I told her, like, you're white, honey. Just deal with it.
It's one of those lines where I think, like, we often forget about it because Feruza Balk gets so many good ones, and I'm like, ah, Rachel True is so good in this movie.
That was bone dry.
She's just got, like, a really dry sense of humor. The film, however, did not end up quote-unquote, helping True's career, like it did for the other stars. She wasn't even invited to the press tour or to the MTV Movie Awards with her castmates, which, this is 1996, guys. But the studio underestimated the black audience that would show up for Rachel 22 years later. We've got African-American critics like Ashley Blackwell of Graveyard Shift Sisters, which, look up her website, Graveyard Shift Sisters. She's still penning pieces on the importance of Rochelle and how disappointed that people were that she was the only character who didn't get a scene with her family because it was cut. On the second season of Unreal, you delved into a space where just like, okay, The Bachelor itself doesn't have African-American people on it, but our show is going to have African-American characters. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit about what that means to you and why you made that decision.
It was really important to me, and it felt like a good thing to do with the show, and I didn't know if we were going to get a third season, so I just felt like, you know, in my list of priorities of, like, why I would want to make that TV show, that was one of them. And I think, like, looking back on it, it was a little foolhardy. Like, I've asked myself, like, would I do it again? Because I felt really, really strongly about doing it. I talked to both like African-American writers in the writer's room about it because I was like, look, you're going to get leaned on. It sucks, but you're going to get leaned on a lot. And how do you feel about doing it? And we talked a lot about white feminism and a lot of the challenges of being a white feminist and a lot of like how was it like a very problematic, scary show to tell that story. One of the scariest parts for me is that really like within that network context, I really don't have final cut on stuff. And ended up having a producer come in and take out some really crucial scenes, and I ended up getting like very personally like attacked for having not had those scenes in there. So there was a lot of complication with it. But I think if I had it to do again, I would still do it because the thing that happened was the next season, the Bachelorette had their first African American Bachelor or Bachelorette. I'm sorry.
It felt to me like you guys were taunting them.
We were actually, and we did it at TCA's when ABC was there, and so it became an actual. It was actually very aggressive. On purpose. So I'm glad that we did it, but it was really complicated, and I don't know that we did it all that well. But we tried really, really hard to get it right. So.
Well, you know, yeah. I'm glad that you had African American writers that you could consult with who felt comfortable being leaned on. I'm assuming.
I mean, I feel like one of them we have talked so much. I mean, she's been in the writer's room since season one and we're really good friends, and I don't know that she felt comfortable all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like I'm saying, like it was a problematic situation just inherently. I don't know that there was a good way to do it, but we all really wanted to do it.
Yeah.
Like that was true. Like we all really, really wanted to do it. We wanted to cast that person, we wanted to tell that story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You just don't want to run into something where you've got like you know, like in history class, if there's like one person of color,
exactly.
And you're like, and you talk about slavery, and you're just like, oh, everyone turns heads and looks at that person. You're
yeah.
like, oh, this is just the most embarrassing, terrible thing.
Oh my God, but it happened over and over again. There was like, you know, I mean, it was sort of built into what we were doing, and that was, I think, really hard on them.
And we're going to take another quick break, and we'll get right back to our conversation with Unreal creator Sarah Gertrude Shapiro.
Hey, Biz, have you seen any good movies lately?
Hey, Teresa, does Curious George's Boo Fest count?
It doesn't.
Well, I blame my current life situation that has small children that need things. God, I love them, and I miss knowing about stuff.
Well, after catching up on the current cultural offerings on podcasts that provide such information, join us on One Bad Mother as we help explore the harsh realities of sweeping self-identity changes as we try to find ourselves between our pre- and post-kid selves.
I used to like all the things. Download One Bad Mother on MaximumFun.org or Apple Podcasts. And yes, there will be swears.
Welcome back. You are listening to Switchblade Sisters. This episode was recorded live at Resident in downtown LA with Sarah Gertrude Shapiro. We talked about the craft. Now back to the show.
I want to talk about some more difficulties that you might have with set stuff. One of the things that this, like specifically being a director, because you also direct on this show, one of the things that they had the biggest problem with, which has become kind of legendary on talk about the craft, is that, you know, Fairuza Balk was a practicing Wiccan at the time of the filming, and they also had a consultant named Pat Devlin who was on, and, you know, they informed the producers that it was actually going to be difficult to film on the beach because it wasn't a good place to have rituals, like pagan rituals and things. And they still did it anyway because they wanted to have this beautiful scene where they film on the beach and they call on men on.
Serpent of old! Ruler of deep! Guardian of the bitter sea! Show us your glory! Show us your power! We pray of thee! We pray of thee! We invoke thee!
That's so cool. So that there's a shot where they have like overhead where there's water creeping up on the beach. And that was not supposed to happen because they had consulted with a ranger to see when the tides would be coming up. And the ranger is like, no, the tides are not supposed to be coming up right now. So they set the whole thing up. But the Wiccan power on set was so gigantic that it wiped out their set. Like, it came in and it took out their set, and they had to, like, rebuild it because it was destroyed by this water that was, like, surging towards them while they were doing the scene, which is incredible. No one has any idea why that happened still to this day, which I think is a great lore to have. But still, it presents some problem solving. You know, as a director, if you've got a huge set piece that is very important and you've got witches calling the sea towards you, what do you do? And you know, you're so like, have you had moments where things just kind of fall apart on set and you have to figure it out? Like, that's director work, is just problem solving.
Yeah, all the time. And it was actually one of the reasons why I didn't direct in the fourth season, because I had an experience where we shoot up in Vancouver and the writer's room is in LA, and I had an experience where I was in a field trying to get a crane to move over a septic tank and like talking to a bunch of Teamsters about like how we were going to move this crane. And then I got a call from the writer's room and they were like, we just got a note and they want to change one of the characters. And I was like, why am I moving a crane? So what I really discovered is that in television, directing is a very, very challenging sort of journeyman job. You move really, really fast. We shoot like 11 to 12 pages a day. It's incredibly hard to make your days. We shoot in the pouring rain. We shoot at night a lot. It's really, really physical work, and stuff goes wrong all the time. And so I have so much admiration for all of our directors. And I'm really glad I did the episodes I did. But I ended up feeling like when we're writing at the same time, it's more important that I'm in the room.
I mean, did you ever have to work with animals? Because I've heard the stories.
Really hard. Animals are so hard.
The stories on this set is like all the snakes fell asleep because it was like too hot. They're like, it's too hot, so the snakes fell asleep. And they're like, oh, shit, you're supposed to be like writhing. And they couldn't get the snakes to writhe, so they had to like put some like CGI in it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We one thing that was really fun that happened on our reel, there's an actor named Craig Bierko who plays the creator of the show, Chet. He's a sort of like stoner Ophi dude who's also like really aggressive and rich and fires people a lot. But he showed up, the actor showed up to set with a dog. He didn't even ask, but he has this rescue dog that sort of is his emotional support animal, and goes everywhere with him. And her name is Boo. And we ended up just sort of allowing her to be in the show. And I don't know how we got away with that, but she's like in sex scenes and stuff, like watching people. She was one of my favorite parts of the show.
That's support. That is, yeah, a support dog.
Yeah, I mean, she's incredible. Like, there's a really crucial scene, and if you look carefully, she's crapping in the bushes. And she's sort of our mascot. Like, we really all really, really love Boo. So.
That's an animal on set for sure. I don't know about you guys, but when I was a kid, I definitely didn't pay attention to Nancy's mom as a character, and have come to really appreciate her more as an adult watching this film. So I did want to shed a little bit of light on this person who doesn't get a lot of credit because she's got such a small role. But she's played by Helen Shaver, who I also didn't realize back then was the Helen Shaver of the Amityville Horror. So she's got this kind of legendary pedigree of, you know, being a character actor. But she took that role so seriously that she said, quote, for me, getting that wig to be right, she's got such a great wig, getting that wig to be right was a very huge part of creating the character that's just women I've observed in the world who clearly fell asleep on their hair, sweat, brushed it the front and not the back, put on too much makeup over the makeup they still had on from yesterday because they didn't wash their face, had another cigarette and hoped for the best, I guess, had a drink and tried to make the world go away. I want to take a quick look at Nancy's mom, just so you guys remember, because you probably have forgotten her by the last time we saw this.
Ever since I was a little girl, I said, all I want in life is a jukebox that plays nothing but Connie Francis records.
That's great. Mm-hmm. Who's Connie Francis?
Oh, shut up, honey. Listen and learn. Connie Francis.
You know my room, girls?
Let's go. It's nice to see you again, Mrs. Jones.
There's Connie Francis. Wait a minute.
Here. Do you guys remember her now?
Yes.
Yes. She's wonderful, and I think that people always forget her, but the thing is that she is a fantastic character actress. She's a person who shows up all the time and just, you know, brings it to a role. And I wanted to make sure that we kind of end on a really great note about talking about some of the actresses that you work with, because you've talked a little bit about Constance Zimmer, who I remember from watching Good Morning Miami back in, oh my God, how old am I? Like 2000 or something like that?
Yeah, it was something like that, yeah.
Can you talk about the actresses or actors that you've worked with where you're like, yes, I want this person specifically because, you know, I've seen them in other things, even if they haven't gotten their credit due as the lead, these supporting characters who are so amazing.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I had a couple of experiences like that with the short film that the show is based on. I had been obsessed with Anna Camp from True Blood. I don't know if you guys know who she is, but she played the preacher's wife. And when I saw it, I was like, who is that? I was like, oh my God, like she's so evil. Like she's so, so sweet and so pretty and so evil. And so I really, really wanted her to play like the Bachelor contestant in my short and stalked her and begged her and stalked her and begged her and stalked her and begged her. And she finally said yes. And she ended up just exceeding all of my expectations. She was really great. And I had the same feeling about Frances Conroy, who was a mom on 6 Feet Under. She plays a psychiatrist in my short. And I could not believe she said yes. I mean, it was just like totally in awe. Like I like she was asking me for direction and my jaw was shaking. Like I just couldn't even talk to her.
What did she ask for direction on? What do you remember?
Oh, she went so deep on the character. I mean, I think she had like half a page probably of dialogue, and she called me like 3 or 4 times before the shoot to say like, so I've been reading Shakespeare and really thinking about how this is a psychiatrist. Like I didn't even know how Shakespeare was related, but she took it really, really seriously. And she showed up and she was super prepared and she wanted to talk everything through, and then she did it once and she goes, what do you think? And I was like, I it's the first time I've actually not been able to talk to anybody. I was so starstruck. I didn't know what to tell her. So that was really amazing. And then Constance, I have to say, like, we tried to cast this role for probably about a month. I think we saw something like 50 actresses, like in a very serious way. We tested 4 other people. We actually shot a pilot with somebody else. I mean, it was a really, really hard role to cast. And Constance had been my first choice from the beginning. Because I had seen her in Entourage and I thought Dana Gordon had like this insane mix of like vulnerability and hardness. And one of the biggest challenges on Unreal has always been tone, and it can become very, very arch, especially with Quinn, because she says horrible things. And so as we were going through the process of trying to cast this role, like everybody who came in, my sort of spiel was like, hey, it's not a joke, don't land it, there's no airstrip. Like you can't, like you have to throw it away, and you have to think you're hilarious, but not crack up. Like it was a really hard thing to describe, and I just had an intuition that Constance would be able to do it. And she got called about a Lifetime script and just turned it down without even, you know, I mean, it was out of the question for her. An actress of that age is a very, very scary thing to get a Lifetime call, or it was at the time.
Oh my God, yeah, a Lifetime call. I wonder what she thought she was getting a call for.
She just turned it down, and she turned it down a bunch of times. And so finally, the executive who bought the show cornered her at a school function because their kids go to school together. And begged her to actually watch the short and actually read the script, and she came in for meetings. So to me, like in terms of just having pure admiration for the craft and for her craft in particular, it truly was a really, really hard role to cast. I mean, like super, super challenging. So
the casting of the craft for sure as well is the same, you know, like thing they
like Feruza, think about like anybody else in that role. There's nobody else.
Could you imagine anyone else in Feruza's role? Like,
no.
Never. Never. And also, Robin Tunney, when she went in, she had just gotten off of Empire Records.
Oh, yeah.
So she came in for a screen test and wasn't even trying to test for this. And she had a shaved head, because you guys remember, you've seen this movie. You've seen Empire Records, yeah. Right? Yeah, so she had like a pixie cut that had grown out from that. And she came in and did a screen test, and she wanted Neve Campbell's role. She was really, really bent on getting Neve Campbell's role. And I thought that that was a really interesting thing, that she didn't want the lead. They had to convince her to be the lead, and she was like, no, I want to be the weirdo. I don't want to be, yeah, like the lead girl.
I can kind of understand why.
I can, you know, if I think about it, yeah, there's no interviews, but at the same time, so Empire Records, if you guys remember, there's a girl who's cutting her wrist. That's her character. And then in this film as well, you have a girl who's cutting her wrist. Mm-hmm. And I can't imagine being an actress who's asked twice in a row to be a, like a teenage girl who is suicidal and a cutter. Like, yeah, you kind of want something else,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and I also feel like she's the most boring character, really. I mean, yeah, yeah. It's, I think it's not the best role. I mean, she's like goody two shoes. She kind of sucks. I mean, I don't really, I don't really love that character. So yeah, and I mean, and in my conversations with Doug about The Craft, like the one thing that I have talked to him about that I really feel like maybe would have been different if they had a woman on their team was like leaving one of your coven in a psych ward is kind of lame, but whatever,
dude.
I mean, but I'm like, I think that's how it had to end, like with the way that it was set up. But it's why I don't love Sarah.
Well, I mean, Sarah has some mixed feminist
her boy stuff. Like her, I just am not. I'm not really about her.
She, I mean, that's the thing. Yeah. She's definitely with Skeet Ulrich's character. She's got some problems with him because she's a little bit boy crazy with, yeah, him still.
Yeah.
He does. He does try to rape her.
He tries to date rape her, and she's like, oh, weird. Like, I'm not really about, yeah, her.
She's, yeah, like, oh, I felt bad for him. I didn't want him to die. Underneath, I thought he was good.
And like, also, it's probably my fault.
Yes.
Because I put a...
Yeah, so she's kind of like a slightly weaker character, so she's a little bit harder to connect with.
Yeah.
And, I mean, she got to play the badass in Empire Records, uh-huh, because she was the one that none of the other women wanted to talk to. They were just like, oh, what's her fucking problem? She just goes in the bathroom and shaves her head. Mm-hmm. She's a weirdo. Yeah. So having to take, you know, that, and then Neve Campbell really wanted her role. And you guys have to remember, Neve Campbell was on Party of Five, but Scream had not taken off. This is pre-Scream, and Scream probably would not have happened if The Craft didn't happen. I think that's something that we need to remember, that this was such a very kind of drought time for women leads, and Neve Campbell having that role in The Craft launched her. I'm curious for you, you know, you've got, like, I don't want to say that you're one of only a few kind of female-led shows on TV, but yours is very, very outwardly feminist, very, very outwardly messy and complicated. Have you seen other things that have premiered or come after that maybe might not have gotten like a green light unless Unreal was on the air?
You know, I feel like that'd be so arrogant that I'm pretty
do scared. Do it.
I'm pretty scared to say. The only thing that I've heard about it actually didn't come out, but it's a pilot that shot this year, that I was like, I hope that we helped get that going. I hope that we helped get that through the process. And it's called Girl Code, and it's a workplace dramedy about like women in Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. And the only reason, and again, like I just feel like it's insanely arrogant to even talk about it this way, but I just think that like getting to the point where people think it's interesting enough to see women working, and that like, that their work relationships with each other are, yeah, interesting enough, yeah. Because I think that, like, and again, it was one of those things that I did not think was a big deal at all, but apparently was sort of noteworthy about Unreal, which is, like, they really don't talk about men. Like, we sort of, like, crushed the Bechdel test. I mean, it's like, they're just like, yeah, I fucked him. Anyways, did you get the thing? Like, it's not, so their primary drive is not about men ever, and it really is, like, dissecting a work relationship between two women, which if you think about a show like The West Wing or, you know, something like that, I mean, it's just... that's held water for men forever and ever and ever. It's a really complicated, rich place to write, but it hadn't happened a lot with women. So that was one thing that I saw that I thought, oh, that's cool that there's like more workplace stuff happening. But I don't know beyond that.
Well, I mean, we can all look for girl code and
I don't know if it's going to go, but I know it's shot. So. Yeah.
As we wrap up, I was hoping that you could just tell me your favorite scene from this film.
It's got to be the beach. I mean, for everybody, right? I think
it's a beach for everyone.
Is it? No.
There's like everyone shaking their head. What? Yeah. Yell out your favorite scene.
Yeah.
Connie Francis.
Connie Francis. All right. Well, I hit your sweet spot. There's one woman who.
I mean, also the last fight.
Pretty amazing.
Oh, the last fight.
The last fight is.
It's so
amazing.
Funny. I almost avoided talking about it because I was like, I don't know how to get into the special effects talk about this.
Oh, it's so good. So good.
Well, I mean.
Flat clothes.
The flat clothes, and then Nancy's like, ooh.
She goes, tricky. It's the best. It's the best. Also, like the dumb ombre scene where she changes her hair color.
Which, I mean, that was a wig anyway, which is what, I was like, oh, they got two different colors of the same wig.
Yeah, tricky is probably is one of the better
ones. Yeah, I do like how unimpressed the girls are when she changes her eyes from green to brown.
Yeah.
They're just like, yeah. I think Nancy says, like, you can do that with contacts. And she's, like, so disappointed in it. Oh, man. I mean, we talked about the writing. I think the writing is great.
I do too. Actually, I'm just saying it's pretty kitsch. I think it's great. I just am saying, like, you really, like, those, yeah, you gotta commit and you gotta just go.
Commit
and go.
Go with it.
Yeah.
Run with your idea. Sarah, is there anything that you want to plug that's coming up besides season 3 of Unreal on Lifetime?
Season 4, we just shot it and wrapped it. So it's gonna be coming and we're super excited about that.
Yay!
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Sarah, for joining me. Thank you guys for coming.
Thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. Next week, we'll be talking to two writer-producers for Bob's Burgers and our first pair of sisters on the podcast. It's Wendy and Lizzie Molyneux. They'll be on to discuss 28 Days Later. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you do, we'll read it on air. We have one review this week, and it's from Sean Newton. And Sean says, I really enjoy the show. Listen while I work in my shop and on the road with my wife to shows. Thank you for making it. Thank you for listening, Sean. If you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at SwitchbladePod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. Please check out our Facebook group, too. It's Facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.